When the river of rebellion overflows, I'll be there. When the seed of discontent plants and grows, I'll be there. Watching for the sun through the dark and rainy storm. Searching for the keys to the dungeons old and worn. Let me tell you, I'll be there. When the shadow of the tyrant falls and sweeps across the land. And when men would steal from others with a paper in their hand.
Welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. It's March 24th. Welcome back. I'll be there. That's Phil Oakes, 1960s and 70s folk singer who was killed in 1975, but his spirit and words live on, brothers and sisters. We're here today, and the question is, will you be there? Especially during the upcoming week, April 14th to 21st, the ITCCS International Day of Action Against Criminal Churches. We've got a whole list of things you can do. And I'm going to talk about that in the last part of the show, just to remind you in the parting shot of what you can do and should start preparing for. But to flag something, April 15th is going to be named as the International Child Holocaust Day. And we're doing that in memory of the first April 15th event. That was April 15th, 2005 in Vancouver, where we established Aboriginal Holocaust Remembrance Day. And that action really led to a lot of the opening up of the truth of genocide in Canada, set up by a group of natives and non-natives, really just a handful of us at the start, called the Friends and Relatives of the Disappeared. Well, the disappeared continue, and I want to put that in our forefront right now. I want us to all remember those children who are going to disappear today and tomorrow if we do not act, because it's easy to get distracted, and that's exactly what's coming down right now. Distraction on the verge of our campaign in April. This always goes on. There's, as some of you probably know, in the wake of the amazing events of the last month, we are under serious attack, once again, by people who you would think would be our allies in the so-called International Tribunal of Natural Justice. Now, I'm not going to dwell on this because that's exactly what they want. They want us to get distracted and focused on irrelevancies, but it's worth mentioning because in the wake of what went on, it's important for people to learn from this and to see the pattern. Over the last month, we found that Jorge Bergoglio, Pope Francis, sidelined from power, and another ritual of the Ninth Circle shut down in Rome at the San Lorenzo Church. Right in the wake of that, Bergoglio then meets with Russell Nelson, the head of the Mormon Church, and more evidence is coming out of the ritual killings and similar crimes going on in Mormon churches as in the Catholic churches, a link clearly to the Ninth Circle, and we believe to the new Mormon temple that has just opened in the northern suburbs of Rome. So on the verge of that coming out, and that's in fact what we're going to be talking about today, because my guest Karen, who we'll have on in a minute, is a former LDS Latter-day Saints church member. She's going to talk about her experience and her voluminous knowledge on the whole subject. But it's important to remember that in the wake of all that, suddenly out of the blue, we got attacked by two guys, Sasha Stone and Robert David Steele, who have a reputation, at least in certain internet circles, as being people taking on these crimes. Well, for some reason, both of them go after me, even though we didn't provoke them in any way, we had pretty much ignored each other, and suddenly accusing me of all sorts of heinous things and trying to get me locked up. As a matter of fact, the most recent email from them is that the Canadian authorities have been notified about me, and they will be evaluating me. Well, it's kind of funny because somebody should tell Bob and Sasha that the Canadian government's actually been evaluating me, nice euphemism, for the last 25 years by monitoring, harassing, disrupting, doing the usual gamut you do against people who are trying to bring out your dirty laundry. Now, Bob and Sasha, next time you're going to go after somebody, I suggest you do your homework. As a matter of fact, this is all documented in one of my recent books, At the Mouth of a Cannon, so I'd be happy to mail you guys a copy so you can bone up on exactly my history, although considering the amount of money the ITNJ has, I suggest you actually buy it, help us out a bit. You can find the links at Amazon under Kevin Annett. That's At the Mouth of a Cannon, the history you need to conduct a really effective smear and takedown. But don't forget, this thing hasn't happened. They've tried for 25 years. We have a great light around the work we do and protection, and I want to reassure people about that. They've received a letter from a lawyer for the ITCCS saying and charging them formally with being engaged in a criminal conspiracy to disrupt this work, And they haven't answered in almost 72 hours, so they're not contesting this. That makes it a fact under the law. They are engaged in criminal activity to stop the work to expose these crimes. You can ask them why. I'm not going to bother. People within the ITNJ are already very upset at their actions, and there's a lot of fallout coming out of this. So we'll let nature take its course. We're going to stay on focused on what really matters. And in that regard, just before I bring Karen on as well, I want to remind you folks that whether these crimes are stopped depends totally on you. We want to ask people to start gearing up for the week in April. There's a lot of things you can do. I'm going to read out the notice at the end of the show, but you can do things as simple as standing outside and inside churches, the Anglican, Catholic, United churches, handing out this information. We have direct action groups that are going to be engaged in making citizen arrests against known child raping priests and others, campaigning to get your government to cancel tax exemptions for these criminal churches, especially the Church of Rome and Church of England. And so there is much we can do, but it depends on all of you who are listening. On that note, let's carry on and talk to Karen. Hello, Karen. Great to have you with us. And I didn't get a chance to, I actually misplaced the little bio you sent me. So I wonder if you could just tell folks a little bit about who you are, your background, and some of what you want to talk about today.
Okay. Well, basically, I was born into the church. We would call that born under the covenant. Many decades ago, the covenant basically means that my parents were married in the Mormon temple. And so progeny is automatically sealed to the parents when that's the case in the afterlife. I've been pretty much of a rebel most of my life. I've smashed a lot of paradigms that I didn't think I could push through, but I'm here to report that I did and I have, and this is very important to me that this information get out there.
That's good. Now, I know that you've got a lot to share. One question maybe to kick off this whole thing, you know, there's been things in the news recently about this trip to Rome, this really unprecedented trip where the top Mormon leaders, including the prophet, meets with Pope Francis, when my reading of Mormon doctrine is that they believe the Pope is the Antichrist, and I know the Catholics believe that the Mormons are a, quote, pagan cult. So do you have any take on why this occurred, or what, I mean, is this being talked about? Is it seen as unusual in Mormon circles, or what do you think?
Well, I'm pretty much out of the Mormon circle ring. I've been out since 1990, but I would say if the majority of the membership knew this had been happening, there would be screams and yells, because Mormonism does call the Pope the Antichrist, and they call the Roman Catholic Church the Whore of Babylon. And I know that, you know, the quote-unquote Catholics haven't wanted to have much to do with the Mormons either, for the exact same reason that you mentioned. So I'm assuming that it is being kept pretty close to the vest in terms of this visit.
Now, I know you. It took a long time for you to actually leave the Mormon Church, and I want to talk a little bit about that. But before that, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your experiences in the church. I know you taught Sunday school, and you were involved in working with young girls, and there was some of that that kind of disenchanted you about the church. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I pretty much had leadership positions in the church most of my adult life. I was young women's president, which is the girls from 13 to 18. I guess it's 12 to 18 now, where they're molded and framed to become young women, young adults. I was in primary as the music director, which is for the young kids. The main goal there is to pretty much indoctrinate them through music and repetitive stories. And I was also in the women's organization as the homemaking counselor, which is the Relief Society presidency, where we teach women how to care for their homes and their children, etc. So one of my last positions was as a Sunday school teacher for 10 and 11-year-old girls. And by this time, I was pretty disenchanted with how I was being treated in the church because of some of the other choices I've made that they disagreed with. And So in that process, as I'm teaching these young girls, I'm trying to get them ready for young women's, where they're going to be objectified as flowers or pieces of bread and butter or interesting things like that. Because once you get into young women's, you are told that when you are in a dating situation, that it is your obligation and responsibility to maintain the tenor of the date, because boys will be boys after all. So we were told never to let the boys lick the butter off our bread, or to pull the petals from our flower, and other such, you know, objectified nonsense. So I was trying to get these girls ready for that. And I was trying to help them to learn discernment and critical thinking, and not to just readily accept everything that you're told from every quarter, particularly if it's a quote-unquote authority who may have a bigger vested interest in your behavior than you have. So that was the main reason there.
So I understand that they took issue with you when you did that.
Just a bit, yeah. At that particular time, my mother was very, very sick, and she was dying. And we had a church teaching that is pretty covert, that says that we have mothers in heaven. And so I really felt like, okay, if I'm losing my earthly mom, I'm going to reach out to my heavenly mother to see if I can get some comfort. And I asked my bishop about that, because there's really been no direction on how to exactly do that. And apparently no one had asked him that question before either. So he referred me to the stake president, and I just decided, I think I'll just bypass the stake president, go directly to the first presidency. So I sent them a letter indicating that I would like some guidance in that area, and that I have been really frustrated in a number of other areas, and asked some relatively inappropriate questions, I suppose, because they sent the letter back to my stake president, who called me in and wanted to have a little one-on-one.
Now, I understand that they eventually accused you of apostasy and fired you as a teacher. Was that right?
Yes, they took me out of that teaching position once they received that letter from the first presidency, yes.
Now, you say you never got a reply to your letter, but they ordered you into kind of like re-education, I guess you'd call it, into a Bible study or face a church court. Seems a bit odd.
Right, exactly. And it was bizarre, because when I went into the meeting, the man that was the state president at the time was also a state senator, and I had worked on his campaign for two campaigns, so we had been on a first-name basis. But the minute I walked in there, all of a sudden he was President so-and-so, and I was Sister so-and-so, and I knew some things had gone down, because we had never talked like that before.
Sorry, Karen, you're saying the man was a United States senator?
Just a state senator here in the state where
senator,
I am.
Oh, a state senator, not a federal. Okay.
Yes.
Yep, got it.
Right.
Yep.
His main concern was that I was angry and bitter, which apparently is inappropriate when you're a member of the LDS Church, because you're supposed to walk around with the pasted-on happy smiley face, because they don't know what to do with you if you think outside the box. You're not allowed to be angry. You're not allowed to be bitter. You're just supposed to swallow the Kool-Aid. Mm-hmm. And he just basically told me I had been directed by the First Presidency to engage in scripture study with him, or they would call a church court.
So what happens in a church court? Did it come to that?
I'm not sure. I doubt it did, but I basically told them, because when they do a church court, they call together the high councilmen of that particular stake, and that's positions that are kind of equal but lateral to the stake president. And they sit around a table and they discuss your case, and they decide whether they are going to lovingly kick you out of the church so that you can be restored to full baptismal privileges down the road once you've jumped through their hoops.
Right. Well, I know, having been through kangaroo church courts, what they're like, but obviously there was no due process. They consider themselves outside the law of the land. Would you say that's
mm-hmm.
fair?
Absolutely. When he told me that, I said, well, you've kind of sealed the deal for me, and if you wish to have a church court, you might as well bring balloons and party favors and have a good time because I won't be there. And I don't accept your authority over me anymore.
So then it takes you 27 years to actually get out of the church. Do you want to talk about why it took so long?
Yeah. Well, the reason it takes so long is because there are many, many layers of bureaucracy, first of all, that you're supposed to jump through in order to reach the people that can actually make that decision. Secondly, they will pretend like you have been removed, but if you don't have that official letter, you're not removed. And the way I knew that was because I had written several letters, and yet every time there was a changing of the guard in my local ward area, like new Relief Society presidency, new bishopric or whatever, sure enough, they'd be knocking on my door trying to re-engage me. So finally, I found quitmormon.org, and I reached out to Mark Noggle, who is the ex-Mormon attorney that runs that. And he is helping people all over pro bono to get out of the church because he knows the right legalese language. And he also knows that there's class action suits waiting to engage if they get any blowback from leaders of the church.
Now, tell me why you think they make it so hard for people to leave.
I've thought about this so much over the years. They just have their fingers in so many pies, and I think it's pretty important for them that their membership stays in lockstep. And if you're going to be walking away, the chances are really good that you're going to be saying things that might gain some traction and that they don't want to have happen.
It kind of reminds me of the way these old Indian residential schools were run. The principle, they had so much to hide in the way of secrets and crimes that one person was in charge. They could fire, silence anyone they wanted. Usually get dictatorship when people have a lot of stuff to hide.
Yes, exactly. And the Mormon Church is notoriously infamous amongst those of us who have left and done some reading and researching and critical thinking that the Mormon Church origins are nothing like what they say they were, and the history of the church itself in its origins is nothing like they say it was. And
so
there's even
that.
More. Okay,
yeah,
go
talk
ahead.
About that briefly. I'm sorry to interrupt once you finish that, but then just say a little bit about, you know, I know Joseph Smith and Brigham Young were Freemasons and that, but maybe you could give us some of the stuff they don't teach you about Mormonism.
Well, from my understanding, prior to Joseph entertaining the concept of the vision that he had been being recruited in his local area back in Palmyra, New York, to be a Freemason. So it was indicated that he was dissatisfied with the churches that were running the show at that time. And his introduction to Freemasonry gave him the in that he thought would allow him to start up a new, whatever you want to call it, group, cult, religion, or whatever. And so everything else about the vision and the Urim and Thummim, which is the decryption stones that he supposedly used to write the Book of Mormon, all of that is just a bunch of nonsense.
Now, if you got up in the church and said this, what would happen to you? I mean, I'm just curious.
Well, I'd be able to have about 3 words, and then I would be escorted out.
Right. Now, you know, I know this is important background because there's some very serious charges are being made against the Mormon Church now, and maybe you can talk a little bit about, like, for example, one of the things you mentioned was there's a former Utah police lieutenant and LDS bishop, David Moss, mm-hmm. who was taken into custody
yes.
for human trafficking. Do you want to talk about that in Utah?
Sure. This ring was discovered during a sting of apparent underage girls posing as prostitutes. And Moss told them that he could manage them and that he had run other girls before in the past. So he told them managing them was different from being a pimp, which clearly it is not. So 7 years ago, Moss was on duty and was found to have been having sexual relationships while on duty. And he resigned from the police department before officials actually charged him. Then he was caught on social media saying explicit things to detectives who were pretending to be underage children. And so the church responded by this. They said, "The behavior alleged in this incident is completely unacceptable and unbecoming of any member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and especially of someone serving in a position of local leadership. Upon learning of this situation, local leaders took immediate steps to relieve him of his role and to identify his replacement." And when I read that, I'm going, gosh, nothing like the pot calling the kettle black.
Well, that's interesting because in a couple of weeks, I didn't mention this to the listeners yet, but we have another former LDS member who actually claims that she was part of rituals where she was raped, traded, and trafficked to a visiting Catholic cardinal at the LDS temple in Salt Lake City, and actually saw Gordon Hinckley and other former prophets actually engaged in the ritual murder, forced abortions, sacrificing the fetus, things like that. Now, you know, of course, it's easy to make those allegations, but do you think the climate exists in the church to allow those kinds of things to go on and not be known?
Absolutely.
There's a testimony, actually, a listener, I'm just getting emails from people as we speak. A listener watched a private ritual, which was secretly video recorded, in a Mormon church. In this ritual, men and women in the circle were dressed in long white robes, women's faces were veiled, and they were doing various hand and arm movements. And you made
yes.
reference to a special kind of inner circle ceremony where there's special underwear people have to wear. Do you want to talk a little bit about these rituals and your experience or knowledge of them?
Well, I was a temple recommend holder. My first marriage was in the temple, so I have attended those ceremonies, and they have changed over the years. I was still participating in temple ceremonies before some of the language was cleaned up to be not so heinous. But basically, in that context in which that listener is referencing, you are in the circle and you are demonstrating to the rest of the people that are there to participate in the ceremony what these various tokens of the priesthood are, and they are they're notated by putting your arm to the square, your right hand, your arm to the square, and making certain promises, and then they used to do these execution of the penalties if you don't do that. And so the execution of the penalties are very similar, from my understanding, to what they require of initiates in Freemasonry. So while your right hand is...
Go ahead. No, I thought you mentioned it. Go ahead. What this right
okay,
is.
So your right hand to the square is then your fingers are together facing up and your thumb is extended out to the side. And you take that thumb during the first part of the execution of the penalty, and you draw it under your left ear, across your neck, and up to the left, to the right ear, demonstrating that you will be unable to speak going forward should you open your mouth. Then there is another execution of the penalty going further after you've accepted more of these tokens of the higher priesthood, where your hand is in the same position and you draw it across your chest from armpit to armpit, indicating another lovely way to bleed out and never be able to participate in anything again. And then finally you are doing the same thing from hip to hip, which is basically disemboweling yourself.
So these are acts people perform in order to maintain silence. In other words, they're acting out ritual killing gestures.
Yes, exactly. And those executions of the penalties have now been removed from the ceremonies.
At least the ones you know of.
Right, the ones that the public participates in, absolutely.
Right. Okay, go on. I know there's a lot here, so feel free to just...
okay, well, the the special underwear. Let me get to my link on that. This is priceless. Okay.
Who wears this underwear? It's kind of odd, eh?
It is. Yeah, it's very odd. Come on, I'm trying to get my little link to move so I can do that. Okay. The people that have been married in the temple and have and or have taken these endowments, which are covenants, promises, etc., are within their rights to wear the ceremonial undergarments, and actually not just be within their rights, but actually required to wear them. And so they are now two-piece. They used to be one-piece. They basically cover you from your neck to just above your knee, and part of your shoulders are covered. And they have markings on the right breast, left breast, navel, and right knee. And the right breast is called the mark of the square, and I imagine that rings some bells for you, which represents exactness and honor in keeping the commandments and covenants of God. The left breast is covered with a symbolic mark of the compass, which is an undeviating course leading to eternal life, a constant reminder that desires, appetites, and passions are to be kept within the bounds the Lord has set, and that all truth may be circumscribed into one great whole. The navel mark represents the need of constant nourishment to body and spirit, and the knee mark suggests that every knee shall bow, and every tongue shall confess that Jesus is the Christ.
Well, I would say all the earmarks of a cult, especially the leadership worship. I mean, I assume that it's a given that the prophet cannot be challenged. There was a story I heard from other Mormons that Brigham Young actually had a group called the Council of 50, and I think they're called the Danites now, who killed anybody who disagreed with the prophet. Do you think those things go on in the Mormon Church? Are there kind of assassinations of the opposition?
Well, Brigham Young was unique in that perspective because he did not believe that the blood atonement of Jesus Christ covered everybody. And in his mind, it did not cover those who questioned the authority of the church, meaning him, or questioning the everlasting covenant of eternal marriage, which is the plural wives thing. He had 53 or 54, I lost count. So he did what they called blood atonement, which was, you know, taking the lives of people who dared to think outside that box.
Well, I know they massacred a wagon train of non-Mormons who went through their territory, the Meadow Mills, Mountain Meadow Massacre, I think it was called, in 1857. Would you say that was like a ritual killing as well, or
I would say so. I think it was possibly, they were running up against local governments everywhere they went because they were proclaiming this land is theirs and that land is theirs without any kind of appropriate methodology for acquiring the land. So they were not making friends where they were traveling, and they were proselytizing in the street and pushing back against local pastors and religions. So they were really not being held very highly amongst the governments as they were traveling through those states.
Right.
I think the Mormon Meadow Massacre was probably a warning to just don't get in our way.
Right. Well, you know, as we learned with the Vatican, for sure, they're probably the biggest example about this. Crimes of the past don't stop. Why would they when the institution's still in power? They just get transmuted and hidden and turned into something else, but they still go on. And you can often follow this through the money. And I'm looking at one of the notes you made. It's really interesting. Can I just read it out and you can comment? U.S. gives China eminent domain over U.S. property beyond high treason. Highlight in this article relates to LDS Church and the Gordon B. Hinckley, who would eventually become president. Through the church-owned Polynesian Cultural Center in Hawaii, he establishes a hard currency pipeline with Beijing exchanging bank trade credits for CIA British MI6 drug services rendered into hard gold and silver while hiding behind the cloak of world religion. This is facilitated by the LDS Church built and controlled Shenzhen Special Economic Zone adjacent to Hong Kong. When Hinckley is made Mormon president, his first official visit as world prophet is to China, where the Chinese communist leaders give him a hero's welcome and a confetti parade. This is as bizarre as the Mormons sitting down with Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, the other day. I mean, what's going on there?
It is. It's right up there. I don't have documentation that can prove anything about this, but based on that headline, which is documented and researched, it has been many of our beliefs that drug running has been taking place through church headquarters. And I believe also that Mitt Romney is probably complicit in that through his Bain Capital ownership.
That's the presidential candidate, Republican candidate. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, it was interesting that he ran in Massachusetts, and when he failed to reach his goals there, he moved to Utah, established residency, and ran just here recently and became a state senator. And it's very sad to me that a U.S. senator. It's sad to me that Mormons tend to vote in lockstep, and they tend to be given somewhat covert instructions to do that over the pulpit. So they don't see the R or the D. They look for the M, essentially, when they're voting.
Right. Well, and I know one of the other Mormon people said that she had information about Mitt Romney's direct complicity in some of these crimes, but do you have any knowledge about that? Or?
No, but I'd sure be open to hear about it, because it's something I've been suspecting for many, many years.
So in other words, the Mormons, I know they've historically had a long relationship with the U.S. military. The CIA and their MKUltra mind control programs would cite the Mormon Church. They obviously are connected at a governmental level. I mean, what is this church, do you think? Like,
well, they established early on that they have ways of making people do things. And I think just the brief discussion that we had of the temple ceremony in and of itself is indicative that people may or may not be willing to do things unless they're being coerced in one way or another. And it was pretty well known when I was still active in the church that there was an awful lot of incest that was going on there. And I think it's possible that through that mechanism, people have been blackmailed and controlled as a result of that. And it's very likely that the ones that have been blackmailed and controlled are the ones that have risen to the top, because they're more reliable to do the bidding of you know, whatever. So
yeah.
That would just be my speculation there. But we do know that Utah is pretty much owned and governed by the church on pretty much every level. The judges, the cops, the you know, state and local leadership. So apparently there's just a lot of things that can be controlled, you know, if they have your dirty linen.
Years ago, I was contacted by somebody in Utah who had tried to document the child trafficking going on, and they were continually blocked by the Attorney General's office. And do you have knowledge of kind of incidents of that when the state government directly worked with the church, like happens elsewhere so often?
I have not been a direct recipient of any kind of clampdown by Utah authorities.
Right.
I do have a friend who was experiencing incest in her home, and this was, you know, she got nowhere, basically. I don't know, now that she's out of the church, whether she'd be able to do anything more about that or not, maybe through other mechanisms. But she had many, many siblings, and they were all experiencing this type of thing in their home.
Now, the witness who's going to be coming on either next week or the week after describes horrible ceremonies going on in the temple. involving for-profits Gordon B. Hinckley, Thomas Munson, Boyd Packer. He's got a whole list, and these are as bad as anything we have ever documented to do with the Ninth Circle in the Catholic Network. And you know, you mentioned you had heard stories about, you know, crimes, but is this in any kind of circulation within the LDS community, these kinds of stories?
I seriously doubt it. There's quite a clampdown on information, and if you're still going to church, you're still drinking the Kool-Aid. So even if you heard something like that, you have already been primed to recognize that there will be many lies told about us, and, you know, don't get yourself involved with the lies, because, you know, that'll only bring your spirit down and that kind of stuff.
The witness describes a tunnel system between the temple in downtown Salt Lake City and the nearby, it's called the Cathedral of the Madeleine, Catholic Church. And she made reference to a Catholic cardinal being at these ceremonies. In fact, she was traded as a young girl to this cardinal for a Catholic girl who was given to the prophet. I think it was Gordon B. Hinckley. Is that in Salt Lake City, is there much of a kind of, quote, ecumenical relation between the Catholic Church and the Mormons? Is it out in the open, or is it never talked about?
No, it's not discussed. You know, they just stick to the party line, the Whore of Babylon and the Antichrist. You'll never hear anything like that coming, you know, oozing through the crevices unless somebody's on their way out and apostatizing and being attacked for such.
Right, yeah. Well, that's the best defense to have if you're a criminal. You say, yeah, you almost semi-admit to it, but then you spin it in the direction you want it to go. We get that all the time. Just looking over your notes. You mentioned the 501c3. Do you want to tell non-American listeners what that is and how churches use that for profit and control?
Sure. The 501c3 is an IRS designation that means that a particular nonprofit organization has been approved to be tax exempt and a charitable organization. And every organized religion that is acknowledged by the IRS has to have this designation. So the problem with that is that it is claiming to be charitable when it is actually for profit. And
right.
I think that's one of the things that is getting the Clinton Foundation into lots of trouble, because they've made billions of dollars claiming to be a charitable foundation when in reality all they are is a big slush fund. So this is the mechanism by which they do that. Now, if the IRS really wanted to go after them, they could, but I suspect that there's enough pressure brought to bear to prevent that through, you know, whatever slimy mechanisms they use to keep that from happening. But the Mormon Church is very, very rich. That the church has to file under a certain category with the IRS only if they manage, or if your company manages the sum of over $100 million. So these types of filings that have had to be made have been made because they are really rich. What they do mostly own is investment companies that manage money, and in total, they're worth a collective $32,769,914,000, and that was at last count, which I think was a couple of years ago.
Well, back up.
And the LDS, what?
$32 billion, did you say? $32 billion.
Yes, $32 billion.
That's the assets of the Latter-day Saint Mormon Church.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're just piddly little getting buyers, right? The LDS Church has not disclosed its finances since 1959, and then when they did, this was what came out, and that was a couple of years ago. The Mormon Church has often long acknowledged their participation in for-profit ventures, including investments in the stock market. What they've never disclosed is the value of these investments, and that has always been left up to speculation. So this basically came out through some whistleblowers.
Karen, you know what's amazing about this? It's yet another example of a parallel system to the Catholic Church, because, of course, the Vatican Bank is a secret society. It can't be audited. You can't know who the directors are. It's, according to Dr. Catherine Horton, it's basically the recipient of all of the slush money and illegal offshore accounts of the 10 major banks in the world. And it sounds like, with that kind of assets, the Mormon Church is tied into that. Maybe that's one of the reasons Russell Nelson had a nice little sit-down with Bergoglio the other day in Vatican City.
I would not be a bit surprised. One other little goodie that people might be interested in relative to Russell Nelson, who is now the quote-unquote prophet, he visited Nairobi, Kenya relatively recently, and he told the audience how they could finally overcome poverty. And this is part of what many of us who have left the church call the double bind, which means you're kind of darned if you do and darned if you don't. And I can go a little bit more into that if you wish. But
please.
Well, let me tell you what Russell Nelson said to these people, and then you'll get a better idea of what that means. He says, "We preach tithing to the poor people of the world because the poor people of the world have had cycles of poverty generation after generation. That same poverty continues from one generation to another until people pay their tithing." So I remember hearing this, that the doors and the windows of heaven will be opened unto you if you pay your tithing, even if it's down to the last widow's mite that they speak of in the Bible.
Oh,
tithing, according to Nelson, is the key to overcoming poverty, and this is part of that double bind. You are poor, you give it to a rich church to stay in good stead. They promise the windows of heaven will be opened to you, and then when that doesn't happen, it's because you don't have the required faith and good works to make it happen.
This is like the papal indulgence. This is exactly almost word for word of what the Catholic Church says about papal indulgences. You pay your way into heaven, basically.
Exactly. So, of course, Nelson, having said that, is very much aware of the tens of billions of dollars of investments that the church has, and he was never going to use that money to help those people break free of poverty. Instead, he asks them for more cash. It's just appalling, but I guess if you're willing to sacrifice babies in the temple, then this kind of pales in comparison to that. But still, this is what, you know, it's just such a darn if you do, darn if you don't moment when you're in the church, because you ask for help and you're supposed to pray with the intent of receiving that help, but you're also supposed to pray with faith. And if you don't have faith, you're supposed to pray for faith. But you see the circular mind screw that they do there? Yeah.
Right. Well, it's, I don't want to say the details. I'm going to leave it up to the person who's going to be our witness who saw these things for themselves. But Russell Nelson apparently was present when these sacrificial rituals did occur in the basement of the temple. And that's the man who just met with Bergoglio in Rome and who's doing all these things.
Right, right. Well, he happens to be a medical doctor as a prophet. And there has been a lot of speculation that he was instrumental in taking out his predecessors until he reached that level to be considered the prophet.
That's what the witness said, that he had actually poisoned his predecessor, Munson, and he had performed an abortion on his own niece, and they used the parts of a fetus in a ritual of some kind, very similar to the cannibalistic rituals in the Ninth Circle, where they have to consume the parts of a newborn baby.
Good Lord. Yeah, it's all so much to take in.
Yes.
And I've been out of the church, like I said, since 1990, but when I heard your interview with Sarah Westall, I literally sat there and cried, because some of my worst fears were being realized. You know, the things that had been covertly mentioned and discussed amongst ex-Mormons, etc. So this has to get traction. It has to get legs.
Well, it is, and that's one of the reasons we're facing all these attacks. It's like you can tell when you're getting close, like the old U.S. Air Force saying, when you're over the target, the flak begins, right?
You betcha.
Yeah, we've got about 5 minutes, so I want to give you the chance to say anything else you haven't mentioned. We can definitely have you back on, but are there websites or things you want to emphasize to the listeners?
Well, there is one website that I have looked into. It's called exmormon.org. And I think that one may have been scrubbed a little bit because it doesn't look quite like it used to. So it's a little less easily worked with. It's not as user-friendly as it used to be. That's one of them. The one I really want to emphasize to people who might be listening who are going to give this some critical thought instead of just dismissing it like the church tells you to do is to start looking into some of the truths of church history. One thing that's fascinating that I read several times is a book called The Salamander Letter. And this is the story of how the quote-unquote first presidency and the apostles were fooled by a guy named Mark Hoffman who claimed to have documents that contradicted official church history. And he was attempting to blackmail the leadership of the church. And my thought was when I was reading that is, okay, these guys claim to be sitting in the highest echelons of the temple, communicating directly with Jesus Christ every day for guidance and direction over the church. And yet they didn't have the discernment to see what this guy was doing and that he had fabricated these documents. And they were jumping through hoops. They were paying him off. They were trying to get the last copies of what he had that were considered these documents and hiding them in the church archives away from anybody being able to see. Another thing I'd like to warn people about is all of this push to get your DNA through 123andMe and Ancestry.com. Those are both controlled either directly or through a majority interest by the Mormon Church. Who is instrumental in getting your DNA and making sure the Vatican has it?
Interesting. I want to talk about that Vatican briefly. Do you know anything about that link to the Vatican and their interest in the DNA and the name research?
Not directly in that regard, but I do know that all of your tithing, missionary fund, building fund, welfare fund donations are reported both to the head of the church, to the governments where you live, and to the Vatican, as well as attendance at meetings. Yes.
Amazing. A listener just sent another question. She wants to know if you know that Mormon in the Oriental language means Satan, and that's why the name was changed to Latter-day Saints. Do you know anything about that? Ever heard anything?
No, but I would not be a bit surprised, because that's just recently come out that Russell Nelson said we're not going to be calling it the Mormon Church anymore. And it's really kind of confusing. I used to be kind of an apologist for the church when people would say, well, they're not Christian. They worship Mormon, or they worship Moroni, or they have their own scriptures. Those scriptures were supposedly intended to walk hand in hand with the Bible, to be a second testimony of Jesus Christ, etc., when he supposedly visited this continent.
When he says they're not the Mormons anymore, and he's meeting with Bergoglio, Bergoglio's plan is of one world church. And
yes.
He's already negotiated the Church of England back in and a lot of the mainstream churches. Looks like the Mormons are going to agree to the same thing, maybe.
I wouldn't be surprised. That's probably just a nice way to start breaking the ice. We're not calling ourselves Mormons anymore. Yeah.
Karen, I really want to thank you for today. Also remind us of the name of that lawyer who helps people get out of the Mormon Church.
His name is Mark A. Naugle, N-A-U-G-E-L, I believe, or it could be L-E, but you would find him at Quit Mormon. QuitMormon.com, I believe.
QuitMormon.com.
If it's not .com.
Is he the lawyer in Salt Lake City?
Yes, he is. He has his own law firm, and he does all of this pro bono. And if you go to that website, he makes it clear that it will always be free. And there's a button down in the lower right-hand corner that you can click on that says, click here to resign from the church.
Okay, excellent. Karen, I want to thank you for coming today, and we'll definitely have you back on in the future. We're going to have more ex-Mormons on the show in the coming weeks. And just thank you.
Fantastic.
Okay.
I'm very grateful to you, Kevin, for being the portal for this. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again. And for listeners, just a reminder of the, again, I mentioned the April 14th to 21st week of action. It's to remember children who have been or are being trafficked, exploited, raped, tortured, and ritually murdered, to document the crime and identify the criminals and to stop their evil by confronting them, exposing them, arresting and prosecuting their institutions. That is our mandate, and you have an obligation to save those lives. If you at all feel moved by what you've heard today, if you're a human being with normal feelings, you have an obligation to do more than think about it or pray about it. We need your bodies in the streets, because those of us who are out there, frankly, we are now faced with a direct frontal assault, and we can be taken out without your help. Or with your help. If it happens, it's really not in our hands. All we can do is be faithful. You know, people often write to me and say, stay safe. No, that's the slogan of a slave. Our job is not to stay safe, because if I had to stay safe, I'd still be back in Port Alberni working for the church. Our job is to stay true to what we know is right. That has a force that can move mountains. We've proven that in practice. That isn't about Kevin Annett doing it. It's about every one of us doing it. So that's a challenge to each one of you. Go to murderbydecree.com. That's where the International Tribunal links now. After they wiped out ITCCS.org, we transferred a lot of the information and the updates to the site murderbydecree.com. Look at the video evidence, the hard evidence of these crimes, and join with us now to stop these recent attacks and to make the April 14th to 21st week of action have an impact that's going to save lives and stop these crimes forever. And if you want to write to us to be involved in that, thecommonland@gmail.com or itccsoffice@gmail.com, murderbydecree.com, and get our books which document all this. Put the name Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, into amazon.com. You'll see all the books and order them and start this action in your community. That's our obligation. That's our challenge. In closing, we're going to listen to a song, again by Phil Oakes, and it's the whole theme of we've got to do it while we're alive, folks. Life is precious and sacred, and while we're here, we have to use that precious life for others and for what's right. So we're going to end on that note with a simple question. You know the problem and what must be done. So if not now, when? And if not you, then who? This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Thank you.
There's no place in this world where I belong.